Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. One of the phrases in the chanting that sometimes is done is a certain person says dukotino dukapareto duk, is overwhelmed with dukkha. A person is immersed or flooded by dukkha, by suffering. And this is that this kind of almost like a keyhole or a little opening in the walls, the dams that we build around ourselves. Ever since we're born, we start to kind of build up these protective layers, build up our idea of ourselves. We try to manipulate and control our environment. We use strategies and tricks which I think are in some ways impossible to explain from what we know in this life. That is, I think that the way that children grow up, some of the things that they can do, I don't think can be fully explained by experiences in this life. For example, the ability to learn language, which young children have. And these things that we use, this kind of incredible complexity of layers of abstraction, all of it trying to remove us from, elevate us from dukkha, isolate us from the experience of suffering. And then sometimes there's this little opening. We peep through a little hole and we realize that this world which we've created around us is just like this tiny haven. It's almost like we're in a little box floating on the ocean. This is one of the classic images found in many myths, is that the hero, when they're born, is enclosed in a box and set adrift on the river or on the ocean. And this is what our life is like. Here we are, we've built up all this protective layers. And just look around. When we actually take a peek, you see this irreducible enormity of our own existence. is overbearing weight, this burden of simply being. Something which we can't we can't escape it, we can't deny it, it's part of every day, it's part of every moment of existence. Sort of holding it all together from moment to moment. And you know, we look at all the tricks that we use to try to hide this, you know, humor, memories, imagination, distractions and entertainment. All of these things sort of keep the truth at bay, they keep it under control. And there was a very powerful quote by Carl Jung. He said something like that all of the it's not a quotation but just a paraphrase, all of the paraphernalia of institutional religions, so all of the rituals, the doctrines, the communities, symbols, the books, all of these things are are constructed specifically and carefully and precisely in order to prevent people from actually gaining or seeing the truth for themselves. That they're all there as a protection from that vastness of reality, which most of us, if we were to see it, would simply be crushed by it. So there's a very important truth in that statement, and it even applies within Buddhism as well. So, for example, I'm reminded of the passages in the, if I remember rightly, I think in the Alagadupama Sutta, which we discussed earlier in the year, and I think it's the Alagadupama Sutta, anyway, one of those Majjhima Suttas, and then a certain person, when he hears the Buddha teaching about Nirvana, and then they have this terror, myself is going to be destroyed, I'm going to be annihilated, I'm not going to be anymore. And so there's this existential fear that arises when we come too close to the truth. And so within Buddhism we construct what we call a path, and it's because the Buddha said that the path itself is a conditioned Dhamma, it's not unconditioned. So it's something which is constructed, something which we do as human beings. Something that we undertake as a deliberate choice. And this path acts as a guide for us. This path, as it were, takes us by the hand and leads us along the way. It's a companion. It's very lonely being in the world. Very lonely being without a community, without having friends, without having a support in the path. And when we recognize the structure of this way, then we, when we make that decision to enter upon this and to try to embody it the best we can, then we immediately gain millions of friends. There are millions of people in the world, maybe billions, who, whether they're Buddhists and also non-Buddhists, who recognize that this is a good thing. They're happy to support and encourage somebody who holds these ideals and who wishes to forward and progress in them. And so we should never disparage or put down somebody who's also made that choice and is progressing in that path, because they're our friends, they're our companions. If we want to criticize or disparage somebody, then criticize or disparage somebody who's acting against the path, somebody who's doing something evil, killing people, destroying the planet. There's plenty of them if we want to dislike somebody. It's funny, isn't it? Often we dislike the people who are closest to us. They're actually very similar to us, but they differ in one crucial thing. And people who are really brutal and horrible, then we don't necessarily hate them unless it's turned personal. So this path can help to bring us or move us in a way that will prepare and gradually open the mind to the truth. So that when that revelation happens, that we don't go mad. And we've talked about this also, that sometimes this does happen. And people who go too deeply, too fast, they can go mad. They're not ready for it. They're not ready to see that vision of the truth. And so all of the different aspects of the path contribute to this. The practice of right view shapes our concepts, our ideas, our theories, our opinions, in a way that moves towards and tends towards the truth and tends towards the Dhamma. So this is not a kind of either or thing. It's a process which is ongoing, and the most fundamental quality which is required is the quality of inquiry. So as long as we're still inquiring, then we hopefully be moving in the right direction. And then that second factor of the path is also very interesting. The right intention. Of course, it's defined, as the suttas often define things, in slightly in a slightly peculiar way, because the sankhapa itself, the right intention or right aspiration, is itself a very positive term. It means like a directed energy and volition of the mind. But it's defined in terms of negative things, of intention of renunciation, of non-ill will and non-harming. So avoiding certain kinds of intentions. So you can... But the reality of it is not a negative thing at all, but it needs to be a very positive thing. In fact, this is really where the power and the direction of the path comes from, is this right motivation. So this is where all of the, you know, the Tony Robbinsons and the various kind of motivational speakers and so on, this is where they make their living, is by focusing on this particular aspect of the path, the right intention, right aspiration. And we need to sort of feel that and embody that very deeply. Part of what that means is that that the reality and the perspective of the Dhamma is embodied on a fundamental level in our minds, and that will influence every aspect of our behavior and our choices. And so we realize that both this is manifests or can be experienced in both the inner and the external aspects of our life. So both in terms of our own aspirations and wishes for ourselves, and also our aspirations and wishes for the community that we're in. So both the immediate community of the monastery or the family or wherever our immediate community is, and also for the broader human society at large. In both of those respects, we have this aspect of right intention. So everything we're doing, we should have a strong energy and direction to be able to accomplish those worthwhile goals. So if we look at what people can do with their lives, you know, we look at how hard people can work, how they can strive. You look at how athletes work with such incredible dedication and energy so that they can stand a tiny fraction of a chance of winning a medal at the Olympics. Incredible effort that they put into. And then what happens? You win your gold medal. What happens is a couple of years later, you can get some nice advertising contracts, if you like, make a bit of money, have a nest egg for yourself, and then what do for the rest of your life? That's it. And so such a limited, short-term benefit, and yet still it can serve as a focus for our energy. So one of the ways that we can focus our energy like that is through having that clarity of the goal and the power of the goal. And so this is like a symbol which we can orientate ourselves towards. So in Buddhism, of course, the goal of Buddhist practice is the realization of Nibbana. So this is one of the things that we should reflect about, Nibbana. Reflect about what it means to end suffering, and to try to make that vivid and alive. Of course, in Nibbana is kind of Nibbana as an idea, as a concept, embraces just about every paradox that you can think about. And so in one sense it's an incredibly abstract and far distant ideal, and yet in another respect it's totally immediate. It's right there in the ending of every sankhara, in the ending of every condition, in the ending of every piece of suffering. We can snatch a glimpse of the nature of Nibbana. Nibbana isn't a thing which is different from any of these things. It's merely the consummation, the perfection of that experience of ending, which is actually happening to us all the time. And so this is why, even though it's true that suffering is like a huge ocean, and it's true that if we try to measure the bounds of suffering, we can never achieve that. It's true that our lives are kind of managed by fairly shonky and unreliable devices that can try to just keep us going from day to day, just kind of prop us up from day to day. And that the weight and the power of suffering is something which can really turn a person's mind. This is something that you see, for example, in activist circles, where very often people who are doing work to help the environment or to help the animals or to help the poor and underprivileged, then they, after a couple of years, they just can't take it anymore. You can't stand seeing any more images of children starving to death in Africa. You can't stand to see any more images of factory farms. You can't stand to see any more images of whales being butchered. And your mind just can't take it anymore. The suffering is too great, and what you can do is too little, so little. So this is by developing this very positive force and power in the mind, almost like you can flip over or illuminate the other side of that equation. Without denying the reality of that suffering, you also affirm the reality of Nibbana as the ending of that suffering. And Nibbana is not a pipe dream. It's not, just something locked away in the old books. It's not something which, can't be experienced in this degenerate age of the Dhamma, as many people would have it. And when we keep that goal in mind, and keep that aspiration in mind, keep that focus in mind, and then we can trace back little bit by little bit to see the logic of that unfolding. As I spoke a little bit earlier, we trace back all of what we see in Nibbana. We want to We need to understand the nature of conditionality, of anicca dukkha anatta. But to do that, our minds need to be clear and bright. We need to be able to be very steady and see things without hindrances and obstructions in the mind. So to do that, we need to develop our samadhi. To develop our samadhi, we need to choose a meditation object. We need to understand that meditation object, study it, and apply ourselves to it with diligence. We need to practice every day. We need to put aside time every day to develop, to practice. It's not going to come to us just by hanging around chatting. It's not going to come to us. I don't know. I've never heard of anyone getting enlightened using a computer yet. I've never heard of anybody getting enlightened while sitting around drinking coffee and chatting. I have heard of people getting enlightened while meditating. And I have heard of people getting enlightened by doing walking meditation. I have heard of people getting enlightened by chanting, or while chanting. Or even just while doing simple things. And staying mindful. So if we want to develop that meditation, we have to look back. Well, what are the supports for meditation? Sense restraint, contentment, not eating to not overeating, not oversleeping, not speaking too much, restraining our speech, watching, being careful, noticing the effects that our speech has on others, and being able to listen. So being able to listen much more than we speak. And of course keeping precepts. Studying the Dhamma, learning around, just getting our understanding together. Creating supportive conditions. Remember that you know, we're in it for the long term. Dhamma is this, and we're not doing a weekend course. We're this is a lifetime thing. And so, according to the law of karma, then what you do comes back to you. So we're here, and we have a very wonderful opportunity to practice in this lifetime. We have a very beautiful monastery. We have teachings available, we have the time and the space to practice. Why is that? Why have we been so blessed? Why are we not like so many other people who are very sincere and really aspire to practice, but are in a culture where that's not so Buddhism, there are no monasteries, or if there are monasteries, that they don't support meditation practice, or there's no teaching of Dhamma, or there aren't good friends to support you and help you. Why is that we have these conditions and others don't? So the Buddhist answer to that is to say, well, these are the results of things that we've done in our past lives. And we, through our choices we made both in this life and in past lives, that we've ended up here, we have got these conditions. So if we want to maintain this, if we want to be able to experience it in the future, we have to continue to put those causes into place by supporting and encouraging the community as a whole, helping to build the monastery, helping to support the community. These things are just as important in our development of the path as anything else. This is why I'm here, why I'm at this monastery. I built this monastery because I reflected that my own good fortune, that in the time that I've been wanting to practice Buddhism, that I had a wonderful opportunity to practice and to meditate, to study the Dhamma with good teachers. And realizing that, you know, it was up to me to try to share this and bring this to other people as well. That this blessing would be something, I wouldn't be honoring this blessing if I wasn't sharing it with others. So this is why this monastery is here. If I didn't feel like that, then this monastery wouldn't be here, none of you would be here. So this is all I wanted to say for this evening, just talking about dukkha, nibbana, and how to move from one to the other. And I offer this to you for your reflection.